can talk loud enough to go all the way back there. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You can? I was going to suggest first that all you gentlemen who've been kind enough to put on your coats, take them off. It's too hot here. I've been told that there are some people here tonight who really do not know very much about Baba, but I didn't really feel that tonight was the time for me to entertain with a lot of anecdotes. If there's time, I'll be glad to tell you some. But it is really a very sacred day, and in the time when we commemorate Baba's sacrifice for us, when he was Jesus. And there are a lot of stories and books and learned intellectuals nowadays who go around subscribing to the idea that maybe he was a myth and maybe he didn't exist and maybe he didn't suffer and maybe he was alive when or drugged when they took him off the cross and all that sort of thing. I have, in my own personal experience, two things that Baba said, which you may or may not have heard. In 1956, when Baba came to the Beth Hotel, the Delmonico Hotel, he called me upstairs the second morning, and he asked me if I was happy. And I told him I wasn't. And I was feeling really grouchy about a number of things. And I had up to here with some things. Sniping at me and one thing another. And I said, and if only I could just use these things better, I could do more work for you. And he looked at me so sternly, and he said, look, when I was Jesus, and they beat me, and they put that thing on my head that drew the blood, he said, I had to stand so much. Can't you take that much? If you could have seen him and how realistically he did it, you would never, ever doubt that he did suffer on the cross. And you would never feel like complaining again about anything. Of course, many of you know the time when he said that in each incarnation he had shown one weakness, and that his weakness as Jesus was the time when he suffered all those hours on the cross until finally he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? He knew better, but it was just his great suffering. I just want you to know that because it came from him, and once you have seen Baba and he has talked with you in such a way, you can never doubt that he was Jesus or that he was anything that he professed to be. Of course, to us, he was the most beautiful being that ever existed. I was very happy to come down here when Phyllis called me. Phyllis and I have been friends for goodness knows how many years. She knew about Baba well before I did, and was down in the village, not in the village, in Gramercy Park, wasn't it, Phyllis, with the Elizabeth and Norena?
Yes.
When I first went up to New York to meet them. And just what happened, just a lucky thing that I got to see him before she did. But he saw her just as much as he ever saw me, and before I think he saw me, I don't know. And we've been firm friends all these many years. And so I was only too happy that I could get free to come down and be with you. I think I would like, if you will, to repeat to you more or less a little talk on love, which I gave in New York last fall. And the reason I would like to do it is because this being the sacred day it is, and has many memories for all of us. Sue Kidder was just reminding me that it was on Good Friday that we all started out for the 69 Darshan, too. But I think that in commemorating the sacrifice that Baba made for us, it is a good time for us to have a reassessment of our own position in relation to him. It is now 3 years since he gave up the body. Many have been in sort of a quandary since then, and I have competition out there. And so I'm going to read to you what I had said before. The reason I read is because when you get started on Baba or any of these things, you're apt to just branch off and land in the blue yonder. And I find that it's better to keep on a course, and so I write out things. I don't have these things that I have to talk about, so I have to sit down. Just before we departed from Guru Prasad at that great darshan of 1969, I went to Erish and I asked him if I could do anything for him. They had done so much for us and had taken care of all our needs, and I naturally felt that it would be nice to try to reciprocate in some way. His reply shocked me to the roots. "Yes, Ivy," he said, "teach me to love as you Sufis love." As astonishment and question were written all over my face, he explained. He said, "You see, I never had time to love Baba. I was always intently watching his gestures to be sure that I understood them. We never had time to just sit and bask in his love." Well, of course, none of us doubt the great love of the Mandali for the Master, and I certainly wonder if Erish didn't overrate us a lot. But a Marid recently sent me a little clipping about a little girl and her dolly. A little girl complained to her mother about her dolls. "Mommy," she said, "I just love them and love them and love them, but they never love me back." Jesus had problems with people who were like that little girl's dolls. The Bible tells us that he went about doing good. He never turned away anyone in need. He talked to the common people in language that they could understand about the Father's love. Everyone should have responded favorably to his claims, but they didn't. Some were simply not impressed with Jesus. In some places, he had to move on prematurely because of their hostility. Not all of his suffering was done in Gethsemane, nor on the cross. The lack of human response to his love must have been his greatest burden. In fact, there are a great many things that the God-man cannot do, because all spiritual growth has to be voluntary. If it were induced and didn't come from the heart, the whole scheme and purpose of creation would be negated. In Matthew 13, we read of Jesus, "Nor could he work many miracles there because of their lack of faith." And it is said in Matthew 23 that once when Jesus climbed the hill above the holy city, he wept bitterly and he sighed, "Jerusalem, how often have I longed to gather your children as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you refused." You will remember Baba's other long disappointments when, as Zoroaster, Muhammad, Buddha, and so forth, he could not teach or help anyone for years and years and years, and in fact not until they were ready. Even in the upper room, when after his crucifixion, Jesus desired to communicate with his mandali, he said, "I still have many things to say to you, but they would be too much for you now." We are still a blind, prejudiced, uncomprehending people. And even when Baba kept telling us that all he wanted from any of us was love, 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 we didn't on the whole know how. And we kept asking him for things or for intellectual discussions. As Jesus, he said, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." And he meant the door to our hearts. Are we still keeping that door shut? The best way to keep it open is to be grateful. Surely no generation has griped as much as this one. When I was a little girl, the slogan went, "Count your blessings." Today's little girl is enticed by the TV and other commercials to count what she lacks and to wear down her parents asking for the new toys, whether they can afford them or not. Surely we can all be grateful that God so loved the world, he sent his only beloved Son to us. And that Son taught us how we should live so that we could be happy in the midst of turbulence and brave in the face of such adversities as we have to meet in order to balance our karma. But his words are often taken out of context. I get especially annoyed with that "don't worry, be happy" card, because what he really said was, "Do your best, then don't worry, be happy." In other words, recapping what he said as Krishna, which was to leave the results to God. In other words, make your efforts and then leave the results of your efforts to God. But too many people keep murmuring about, "I guess Baba didn't want me to have that job," when either he was late for the interview or he didn't fill the requirements. "Or I guess Baba wanted me to have that accident," when in fact such things were personally earned by the person when he conditioned his life by his previous incarnations. I feel that Baba has been made the big scapegoat and the excuse for all cop-outs. Baba had repeatedly told us it is all right for us to have ambitions. One cannot live without aiming at some outcropping of personal potential. And wealth and beautiful things we could have as long as we do not become too attached to them. Even a perfect master, because of karma, could end up as a great king such as Janaka. But I have found endless young people, and believe me, they come to our center all the time, who are copping out on this theme too. They feel very virtuous because they don't want the responsibilities of possessions or administering the business of vast corporations, which try to really do well for their hundreds of thousands of stockholders, which are composed of widows and orphans and poor people trying to save to put their children through college or for their old age. You know, the establishment isn't all that black. Even if I did have a lot to do with the establishment for 40 years, You have to remember that that's why I know about it. I know its weaknesses as well as its strengths. I'm not that pro, but I think too many young people are too negative about it. There has to be what Buddha called the middle road. So what do all these people do who keep feeling so virtuous about not having anything for religion or for spreading Baba's message? The Baba said, let your life itself be my message of love and truth to others. But I find young people practicing free sex in the commune and elsewhere and labeling it love. In the chapter on the sanctification of married life, Baba spells it out as to the difference between sex and love. And I'm sure almost all of you have heard that darn tape on the subject that I gave in Berkeley. It seems to me it's been all over the country. But love has to be spiritual as well as physical. And as I've said before, you just can't wear a fig leaf over your face. To go back to the virtues of not making money, the Sufis were commanded by Baba to publish his books so that all of you might have a chance to read the knowledge that he gives. And I wonder if you have any idea of the shock that we received when Dodd Mead told us that we'd have to pay $16,000 for publishing God Speaks in 1955. We had our summer school, our real ashram, as it were, in Fairbanks, burned down. But we only got $8,000 or $9,000 insurance because my Mercer was not a businesswoman, and the place had grown and grown and grown, and never once had anybody suggested that from the day that the first thing that was built started, that the insurance should go on up over the years. And so that was all we got from that, and Baba said, put it into the book. So we did. And we begged, and we borrowed, and we just did everything to raise money, and finally got that book published. Now, actually, it took us 10 years to sell that first edition of 5,000 copies. And when the 10 years were gone, we were $900 in the red. And Baba had told us that whatever the profits we made from God Speaks, we must give half of them to Elizabeth Patterson's center there in Myrtle Beach. And we didn't have anything to give her. So I wrote back to Baba and I told him what the situation was, and so he said, well, when you make up the $900, then you start and give Elizabeth her share. So you see, it's been a great relief to us that Harper and Row took over four of our books. And I'm happy to say that while we only get, I think, 6 cents or something like that for each book, and they're not the prettiest books in the world the way that they were printed, but they promised us to do better with Baba's picture and so forth. But I'm happy to say that the first one they took, Listen Humanity, they got it ready about 6 weeks before it was to be publicly known as published, and sent their salesman out on the road with it. And the salesman took a very dim view of it because they had never heard of Mayor Baba, and they certainly had never heard of Don Stevens. And then they went out to the bookstores and found everybody knew about Baba and Don Stevens, and they sold 7,000 copies in those 6 weeks before the thing publicly went on the market. And I'm told that our other small book, Beams, and Life at Its Best, have now also sold about 7,000 or 8,000 copies, and they've just put my book on recently, and I haven't any figures on that. I'm only saying that this shows what distribution can do, and this, of course, was the thing that the Sufis suffered from for all these years. 56 on, we had no great distribution, but as Baba became better known, then we became known as a place where, as a source where they could get these things, you see. But the point is that, as the Sufis always say, that the heart with God and the hands for work. And it's a terrible lot of work handling books, as you probably know here, and in Huntington Beach or elsewhere. The shipping out of orders and keeping track of them and all the stuff that goes on is one grand headache. And so we were very glad when Harper and Row took over the few that they did take. Now to get back to the business about the heart and the hands. Baba also made another remark about hearts. He said, big hearts always give and give in. And we're not so good about that giving in part. There is this constant ego trip of standing on our rights. We don't remember that violence should be toward our own egos. Everybody nowadays wants to do their own thing, regardless of the happiness of others. The search for identity and how to justify having your own way, which is a preeminent theme today, is simply mystifying to a person of my age. And in case you're wondering, I'm 77. We never ran over to the psychiatrist to give us comfortable names for all our shortcomings. Don't take this as a put-down, you know, of the profession, because God knows they have their place. But the traditional concepts that we were brought up with of sin and guilt and repentance, forgiveness, reconciliation, and so forth, they don't seem to be remembered anymore. There is a new cop-out. People just can't stand to feel inferior. They can still feel superior if they're told that they have an inferiority complex. I remember the late Bishop Pike telling about a psychiatrist who got so weary of a patient who kept coming to him about his guilt complex, and one day the psychiatrist retorted, "Sir, I have news for you. You haven't got a guilt complex, you've got guilt." Family life has been broken down because people do not have the elasticity nor the endurance to handle it. They don't work on themselves to be flexible and harmonious. They shunt their old folks off into nursing homes and senior citizen developments where they never have the pleasure of children's laughter, and the poor little tykes do not have a grandma or grandpa to confide in and ask questions of, which they might hesitate to ask of their own parents. And now, since domestic service is no longer an occupation to enter with pride, women are left without help to struggle with the endless, faulty, noisy machines and the chauffeuring, so that they swallow with gratitude the idea of giving their overactive progeny some Ritalin and other drugs to quiet them down. Too many fathers would rather watch baseball on the TV than play with the children, and then they wonder why the children become alienated later on. Baba once stated, "From my own point of view, the atheist who honorably accepts his worldly responsibilities and discharges them conscientiously is far more blessed than the man who thinks he is a devout believer in God and yet shirks the responsibilities apportioned to him by divine law. For the past 25 years or so, we have been projecting our thoughts to outer space, to new regions of the earth, to satellites and planets, to the mysteries of the universe, light, sound, ocean depth, and so forth. And now we begin worrying about inner space, and we discover that we reached out so far that now we are asked to get acquainted with ourselves and our fellow man by holding hands and encounter groups and awareness groups and all of that. All they're saying is what Baba has told us throughout the centuries, that we really have to be reborn. We have to get rid of the rubbish of all of our samskaras to find our inner core and our real self. All we have to do is to live as Baba directed in the discourses. But don't be a hypocrite. Baba says hypocrisy is the one sin that God does not forgive. St. Augustine said, love God and do what you please. Now this is the type of loving Baba one sees. A happy man is a great boon to his community. Sufism, of course, is based on developing the heart quality, obedience to Baba's guidance, and selfless service. About the only time that you get off the dime of yourself is to change your center by putting your mind onto helping someone else. If you can do little else, you can at least appear among others clean, neat, and self-respecting. Baba never let his devotees be sloppy. He expected them to remember that the bodies that he had given them were the only habitations their souls could use in the gross world. And since we have to achieve liberation right here, in the body, we had better value it and take good care of it. The great Khalil Gibran writes in The Prophet, for even as love crowns you, so shall he crucify you. Even as he is for your growth, so is he for your pruning. And Baba really pruned us. So don't let the gardens of your loving hearts revert to weeds and jungle again, just because we're living in the Kali Yuga age, which Baba told us was the worst age that the world had ever seen. We have to keep in remembrance the God-man and what love is. The Master said, theoretical brooding on love will result in weaving a theory about love, but the heart will remain as empty as before. And one very noticeable aspect of people today is that they all seem to be lonely. Our constant prayer to Baba should be what Eric spoke of, teach me to love. And since I had that trip back east last September, I've been deluged with lots of letters from young people that I met, or their friends whom I've never met. And I decided that they just didn't catch my name. They think I was Ann Landers or what's her name?
Dear Abby.
There just seems to be a wave everywhere of taking stock and trying to understand just what it means to follow Baba. And they're squirming under the implications. And I'd like to read you a letter that I got recently from a girl in Virginia. Quote, I have been doing a lot of psychology reading and have come across a conflict defining the difference between following Baba's Dhamma on his view on sex and psychologically speaking about sexual repression. In the spiritual aspect, I feel clear about being celibate, but since I'm dealing with this life, I seem to feel this kind of complication. There should be some kind of medium of which we can be safely balancing out our own feelings and in turn following clearly with Baba's word. How exactly can I deal with it? I find myself confronted in expressing real feelings, but in turn an incredible conflict arises from it. Dealing with emotions is an extremely intricate process in which honesty is the only pattern for release, release of any tension, hostility, anger. To expel that anger within a situation toward a person who has caused you to react that way and yet stay clear of Baba's word. In what way can you bind yourself to be free of it and yet carry it out? Written in the Universal Message under the Seven Realities of Real Knowledge, it states, to harm no one in thought, word, or deed, not even those who harm you. Well, does it sound familiar? I see the same confusion right in San Francisco. I've often mentioned before one of C.S., he's one of my favorite authors, C.S. Lewis, and he wrote a little book called The Great Divorce. And in that, it's a story of a group of people who are really dead and have just gone into the next world. He travels with them and tells what goes on. It's the best book on samskaras I have ever read. But there's a Scotch guide in it, and he tells one of these men, you can't have a little bit of hell in heaven. But this is what this girl wanted. Well, I've talked endlessly, really, about sex and boy and girl relationships, knowing full well that they look at me and think, well, after all, at her age, you know. What they don't know, of course, is that Baba gave me this job and some pretty explicit instructions about it. I've always been trying to impress upon the Sufis that the most important thing with the boy-girl relationships is to learn to be friends. No marriage can exist successfully if you haven't learned to be friends with your mate. It's just impossible. But I find that some are still trying to find out how far they can go and still keep within the letter of Baba's law. And if they're going to split hairs and calculate what they can get by with, then they really don't love Baba. And they're still the captives of their desire nature. When Baba told his men when they were going to the West for their education, no womanizing, they weren't given compasses and rulers to find out how far they could go. They were simply told to keep clean in their thoughts and act until they could or would marry. The letter, of course, that I've just read you would indicate that we shouldn't restrain our feelings. Well, if that be so, then we had better have second thoughts about following the Master. One of the sages said, take care that you guard your innermost thoughts, for he knows all of our hearts. And Jesus said this repeatedly, and Baba has reiterated it many, many times. I find that the same sort of confused thinking among young people about life and about work in the world goes on. After the 1,001 times it has been explained that only God exists, how can life and work be so separated and fragmented from Him? There's no such thing as work that is not spiritual. God doesn't say this work is spiritual and that work is not. He says, do your work, whatever it is, in a spiritual way. And that means honestly, bravely, cheerfully, and without intellectual war on your fellow man. It's not wrong to have ambitions, as I said before, to aspire for advancement. This is not really an ego trip per se. Jim McGrew recently wrote me from Boston that people returning from India were profoundly affected by Adi and Mergi, who felt that young Western Baba lovers were too lax and irresponsible in their attitude toward Baba, that they used the theory of karma to rationalize doing whatever they wanted to do, and that they avoided responsibility by thinking Baba is doing this instead of I am doing this. Well, this, of course, needs to be repeated just every so often. I feel that it's really time to take stock. You know, they do this in firms a couple of times a year. And it's time for us to make a new commitment to Baba. This Friday night recalls his suffering, his crucifixion for us. Many of us here were there at that time, and we're still here 2,000 years later. How long does it take to learn? It's very discouraging. Baba hasn't gone away. He is the Parvatigar. Now, Parvatigar is a Sufi word which is the equivalent of Vishnu, the sustainer. You know, God has these three aspects, the creator, the sustainer, and the destroyer. Vishnu was known as the sustainer. Parvatigar is the sustainer. And Baba is, was, and always will be the sustainer. He is that special, most important part of God, as it were. He's always with us, and we breathe with his breath. I heard somewhere, and I don't know where, there's so many rumors flying around, that Baba had said he would be especially concerned with the world for 14 years after he gave up the body. I have no idea. There's a tremendous lot of speculation about his manifestation, and there's many ideas about that, as there are people, I guess. I personally feel that we are now going through the period that Baba called his humiliation. I think he's being humiliated constantly by all of the ways that people are behaving and the things that are going on. But time alone will tell. I have great hope that there will be some definite manifestation other than the idea that as one tells another, that is the manifestation, because Baba did say that it would be something that had never happened before and that everybody would feel it according to the amount of light they had in their own light bulb. Baba used to say that obedience was greater than love. Those who surrendered to Baba in the body, such as Phyllis, my daughter and I did, and I suppose others of you, we know that obedience means
exactly what it is, literal obedience. Those of you who have surrendered to him in your prayers and thoughts and minds since then, you have to go very much by what Baba laid out in the discourses and in his other works as to just what you should do. 3 years ago, when we were in Zurich on our way to the great darshan, my daughter and I had talked with Irene Billow, who was one of the early ones who went to India and stayed the ashram with Baba. And she said that after being there for those years, suddenly Baba told her she was to go back to Switzerland. So she waited, expecting him any minute to call her in and give her some definite rules of conduct, whatever you want to call it, some directions for what her life was to be when she got back home to Switzerland. And nothing happened. And she got more and more perplexed and more worried about it. And finally, when she had a chance to speak to him, she said, "But Baba, aren't you going to tell me what I should do?" And he looked at her and he said, of course we always say he said, you know, he dictated it. He said, "You have been here all these years and you still don't know what to do?" That was all he said. So you must remember that. He's laid out very clearly what we should do and what we shouldn't do. It's up to you to decide whether you can surrender enough to Baba to want to do these things. If you can't, then leave it alone. Don't toy with it, don't play with it, because Baba always said that it was better to go along with your life in the usual ways, but he really preferred people who were what we would call bad people or sinners to people who were indifferent, because if they were indifferent, they weren't thinking about him. But the point is that it is not good to pretend to be Baba lovers. I heard him one time say, "Yes, they love me their way, but you love me my way." And sounds egotistical to repeat it, but the point is that there's a very great difference there that I think is important for everyone to remember. Do we love him his way? Or do we just rattle along and have nice talks about Baba and how groovy it is and so forth, and not really do what he wants us to do? I think it's very important that you realize your place in history. In history. When we were in Myrtle Beach in 1952, wasn't it, Phyllis? Baba said, 1,000 years from now, people will be singing about this day in the barn. You remember that? It was so beautiful. But we couldn't realize then what it meant. Now that we're getting older and we see all you young people coming along full of zest, we're beginning to have a better realization of what it meant. And it's an important thing for you to realize that you who love Baba are the progenitors of the new life. Who is to do this? Who is to set the patterns of the new life, the new humanity that Baba wants in the world, if you're not going to do it? You have a very, very heavy responsibility if you claim to love Baba. You must try to live in such a way as to be Baba's message of love and truth, because they can't see it anywhere else. And there's no other way to see it. You can talk to people and preach to people and give them books to read and everything else, but it never, never, never will give the effect of Baba, such as you're doing a kind thing for somebody, such as not telling lies, such as doing what you know Baba wants you to do. The very fact of repeating his name and thinking about him will put a light in your eyes and a smile in your face,